You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about the expanding world of printmaking today. I'm your host, Nick Naughton. The Printcast brings you interviews with some of the best contemporary printmakers, sharing anecdotes, business ideas, and technical tips with listeners everywhere. I wanted to bring you an old school Printcast episode today because, well, I think it's time that we start doing that. So for today, let's venture back into print history and into the acclaimed studio Atelier 17. Atelier 17 operated in mid-century New York and moved to the States around World War II. And interestingly, most of the influential artists of the 40s and 50s came through and made prints there. On the show today is author Christina Weil to talk about her new book, The Women of Atelier 17. I bet most of us can trace our place in the print world back to an artist who worked at Atelier 17 at some point. Frankly, I think that energy from that studio is still pulsing through the creative arteries of all of us who are pulling prints today. If you haven't got a copy of her book, it's well worth a read, and you can learn a lot of interesting history about women printmakers who haven't really gotten enough attention until now. Finally, thanks to my latest patrons, Lino Bill Fick and Kari Christensen, also known as The Printmaker and Her Dog on Instagram if you follow her. I appreciate the support so much from them and from anyone who's supporting the show. It truly motivates me to keep cranking on it, and thank you. You can donate, too, by going to patreon.com/theprintcast. I hope wherever you are out there that you're safe and healthy. Let's get on to the show, then, and we'll dig into some history of printmaking.
So you have this varied level of students who are coming in to Atelier 17, but everybody is held to the same standard that you must kind of pick up the basics of making a print and then do something more with it. Something about the process of making a print was supposed to be generative for you, to generate more ideas, to take you in a new direction, to take printmaking as a field in a new direction. It wasn't a place to just sort of learn a rote skill and make additions. That was not what Atelier 17's mission was, ever.
You're listening to The Printcast, a podcast about a dying art form finding new life and the artists in the studio making it happen.
Art history is well known for its prioritization of male artists' work, with criticism, theory, exhibition records, and collections reflecting the dominant patriarchal system that's existed throughout much of history. It's only been in recent decades that researchers and critics have re-examined historical archives to illuminate the contributions by women in art. It's a Herculean task because art created by women was relegated technically for displaying simple kitchen craft, or it was reviewed to be of a lesser feminine quality, a perspective that skewed the historical record by limiting the scholarship around the work of these artists. My guest today expands on what we know about women in the print field with her recent book titled The Women of Atelier 17, Modernist Printmaking in Mid-Century New York. The book highlights the work of artists who shared the studio at Atelier 17, the famed print studio started by Stanley William Hayter. Known for its openness to take on both male and female students, the print shop had a far-reaching impact in the development of printmaking as a standalone art medium. To quote the author, Atelier 17 is a truly massive topic that cannot be boiled down to a singular story. Shedding light on the studio's female members during its New York years is one step in expanding its history and unraveling its complexity, though certainly not the end. Christina Weil is an independent art historian who writes about mid-century American printmaking and women artists. She has a BA from Georgetown University and an MA and PhD in art history from Rutgers University. The Women of Atelier 17, Modernist Printmaking in Mid-Century New York, was published by Yale University Press in June of 2019. The book follows nine women, including Louise Bourgeois and Louise Nevelson, who worked at Atelier 17, the avant-garde printmaking workshop located in New York City from between 1940 and 1955. Join us as we learn about the feminine perspective of print history. Christina Weil, welcome to the Printcast.
Thank you, Nick. It's so nice to talk to you today.
Yeah, likewise. I really commend you on doing what I imagine was a really, a lot of hard work putting this book together. It seems like a gargantuan task.
It did take a while. It started probably in 2010, as I was in grad school and, you know, kind of looking for a topic, and my sort of advisor recommended I start looking at the prints of Louise Nevelson, and that became a seminar paper And then from there, you know, it sort of turned into this larger project, which was first the dissertation that I sort of put forth and got my PhD for it at Rutgers. And then it took another, I think I finished in 2015. So it took another, 5 years to get it published? So a long time.
Yeah, that's a long track. So I imagine, you know, in the beginning, you didn't probably set out to write the book or like know you would, but like, how did you go about it? Because I gather from like what I was reading, like you had to search through like, you know, many individual artists' archives and, you know, probably read everything you could find on art movements, theory, criticism. But you're trying to like glean these little moments that speak to the women artists who are involved in the studio, you know, because it wasn't documented very heavily.
Right. So that's sort of how the project started. I was very fortunate to have this catalog that another curator put together in 1977 in honor of Atelier 17's 50th anniversary. And that was put out by Joanne Moser, who was a longtime curator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum. It's a great sort of overview of Atelier 17 for anybody who's kind of like looking for that major resource. But what Joanne did, which was so great, is she went through Hayter's collection, because he exchanged prints with most of the printmakers. She went through his Rolodex. She went through all kinds of exhibition records, because the studio exhibited as a group many times over the course of its almost 60-year history. So she had this list of artists, and I started with something like 55 women who are in her index. And as I went through, I sort of picked a few that I knew I could get access to archival papers. So that included Louise Nevelson, Louise Bourgeois, Alice Trumbull Mason, Minna Citron, Anne Ryan, Warden Day, Dorothy Daner, and I'm probably forgetting somebody. Oh, Sue Fuller. So those are the eight who are sort of the core of the book. And I focused on them most heavily. None of the chapters are about one of them, but they just sort of come in and out as the book moves on. It was really the archival papers that limited who I could talk to, who I could like learn the most about. And then as I went through and I finished the book manuscript, I don't know if you got a chance to see this, but I put together a website, a sort of affiliated website with biographies of all of the women who were on the roster for Atelier 17 during this 15-year period. And I was able to expand the list from like 55 to close to 100. And that was just sort of by talking with print dealers, galleries, artists who at the time I started were still alive. And just continuing to really probe into the archival material and seeing, oh, so-and-so talked about having seen this person at Atelier 17, or this person made a print. And so you're able to kind of piece together this really unwritten history of, it's not just women. I mean, there's so many men who aren't documented in Joanne Moser's book. I mean, she did a great job like putting together this basic list. But as I say, and you quoted, this is just the beginning. There's so much more that you could study about the studio if you really took the time to delve into what's out there. And there's a lot out there.
Oh, most definitely. Like I have to say, for me, now I come from, it was interesting at the very end in like the final section of the book, like you talked about, what is it, the designation like H1 or H2? It's sort of like how many degrees away from Hayter you work.
Yeah, it's sort of a mathematical concept. I think people use, my husband is sort of a numbers guy. It's a way that that mathematicians count their degree of separation from kind of like the person, the sort of a major source. Like if you studied with Einstein or if you studied with a student of Einstein's, etc. I don't think Einstein has a number. There are other people. Who have these numbers in math. But anyway, H numbers are a way that that people have sort of thought about their genealogy and their closeness to this massive and really important print studio. So it's, I think it's just it's more than that, though. It's not just about these relationships, because so many of the nodes after, you know, Hayter set up the studio in New York and Paris, the sort of centers became university programs. So there was a big one set up at University of Iowa, which obviously you know quite a bit about, by Mauricio Lozansky, and then Gabor Pederdy went to Yale. Lee Chesney was at a couple of different places, but these became centers. Fred Becker was at the University of Washington, St. Louis. And so these became centers for more dynamic research and work in printmaking. And unfortunately, the times being what they were, it was very difficult for women to get those kinds of jobs, those university academic jobs. So many of them were forced to either open their own studios, which a handful of them did, or work independently, which was quite difficult. I mean, what was sustaining you? I mean, you had to have some kind of livelihood. And a lot of them went into teaching at the sort of at the high school and the grade school level. And so they had influence, but just not in that same, you know, university academic environment. So it's harder, I think, to sort of trace those women in these age numbers, because they don't have that concentrated group of students who study with them and then go out and continue to influence in their network, if that makes sense.
Well, sure. And yeah, and it sounded like there was, I mean, all kinds of impediments to getting anywhere, where, like, you know, women artists who are doing similar work to, like, their contemporaries like Hayter or other people at the studio, they would, you know, you talked about reviews between different shows that they would have and how one artist would be exalted for their technique, the male artist would be. And then a woman who's doing a very similar technical approach, like almost like the prints are kind of relatives of one another, would be relegated to, like, being a craftsperson, or, you know, reflects, you know, I thought it was really interesting, like, the talk about fabric and how it was, like, attached to, like, feminine arts and crafts, and how, like, certain uses of fabric by women would just, like, automatically downgrade their work in comparison to men who were also using fabric in the same exact methods. And yet it was, like, edgy or just understood in a different light. It was just really odd, you know. So I get, like, how after working at the studio, so many people went on to do different things, but it's like the women didn't have all these opportunities that the men did. And so it kind of changed how they could impact things later, in a way, you know?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I have no doubt that if some of these women, particularly the ones who are more technically savvy, like if Sue Fuller had gotten a career teaching job, although I'm not sure that that was really where she wanted to go. If she had gotten a teaching job, she would have been one of these Lozansky-like, she just would have been this formidable center, because she just knew so much and she wanted to figure things out. But, you know, because of the way that things were, and also her own interests, printmaking was an important part of her career at the beginning. And then it did spur her to go on to do different work in wrapping string and thread around open frames. But she got that directly from the idea of making these soft ground etchings with collaged pieces of lace and fabric. But you know, I think others for sure would have wanted those academic jobs, like Warden Day. She held on by the skin of her teeth throughout her life. I mean, at one point she's living in a unheated one-room studio in Montclair, and I mean, in the middle of winter, and you know, that's terribly challenging for her. So you know, it was, everybody navigated the best they could, given where they were.
Sure. I mean, why don't we paint a picture, like, so people understand, like, what the Atelier 17 was, and also, like, the time it was in, because it ran quite a long run. I never understood that it went as long as it did, but it began in Europe, came to the U.S. around World War II, and then returned to Europe at some point later, right?
Right. So it was founded in the late 20s, in Paris. And, you know, at the time, Paris was really the center of the art world, or one of, it was the major one, but it wasn't the only. But it was really a meeting place for artists from the Americas. There was a huge contingent of Latin American artists who would come to Paris in this time. Artists also from Japan, from, you know, Eastern Europe, they all congregated in Paris because that's where you could get education and that's where you could show your work, because there was a very robust network of galleries and you know, sort of annual salons that were open to a variety of different kinds of work. But of course, you know, they were very open to modernist styles. So Haider was British and had been trained in chemistry and geology, actually worked in oil fields in what's now Iraq. And he came back after a couple of years having contracted malaria and really decided that he wanted to be an artist. So he moves to Paris and kind of is like not sure what he's doing, you know, kind of meets a bunch of expats. And through his girlfriend, he ends up meeting this woman who, his girlfriend was an American artist who'd come to Paris. And one of her very good friends was also in Paris. Her name was Mary Huntoon. She's from Kansas. And Mary Huntoon gives him some basic lessons on how to make a print. So they learned how to do aquatint together, etching. And then through that, he just becomes very interested in this. He and his now wife have a show together. And that's when he starts to get this attention. You know, he's exhibiting with a bunch of he's exhibiting at a salon called the Salon des Independents, Sur Independents. There are a whole bunch of different ones. Anyway, he gets the attention. Two women, one Canadian, one American, come to his studio looking to buy prints. And he sells them prints that he had shown in one of these salons or gallery shows. And then they come back and they say, gosh, we'd really like for you to teach us. And then it just kind of snowballs from there. You know, he starts to have this studio in his own apartment. I mean, he has a press. He gets a press. He begins to have this small group of people who, through word of mouth, know that he's teaching prints. He also, in the interim, you know, between when he started showing this work and studied with Mary Huntoon, he works with a very famous engraver named Joseph Hecht, who was Polish. But like highly regarded as this sort of kind of a very stylized Art Nouveau way of engraving. And a lot of his work are of animals, and his most famous portfolio of the 20s is of Noah's Ark. They're really great, charming prints if you ever get a chance to see them in person. So he builds up this reputation for teaching and becoming this amazing engraver. And he also falls in with the Surrealists. And so many of the Surrealists begin coming to Atelier 17 in the 30s. So Max Ernst is coming in, Yves Tanguay is coming in, Pablo Picasso is coming in for attention, for, you know, like advice and how he should be making his plates. And so it becomes this really robust center of both printmaking and also surrealism, although you could do anything you wanted. And there were plenty of artists who came into the studio who did not follow surrealist ideas. And the studio moves a few times, and it's not until it gets to its last location that it's at 17 Rue Campagne Première, which is how it gets its name, Atelier 17. I think before it moved there, it was just literally called something like Chez Bills or Chez Haider. And people would just kind of go. He did teach people twice a day, once in the morning and once in the afternoon. He had sort of a beginners group and a more advanced group. And that became more formalized as the studio got bigger. But they were probably about 50 artists, at least, that we know of who worked at the studio when it was in Paris. And then it, of course, came to a halt when the Nazis invaded Paris and everybody fled. And Haider came to the U.S. because at that point he had married a different American artist named Helen Phillips. And they settled finally in New York City, which is where many of his surrealist compatriots were also settling at, particularly at the New School for Social Research, which was great because then the New School became this new American center for the dissemination of surrealist ideas. And so then Hayter had the studio here in New York from about 1940 until 1955. He never really liked living in America, and so moved back with his wife and two children in the late 40s and reestablished Atelier 17 in Paris in 1950. So they run concurrently together for about 5 years. And then it continues in Paris until his death in the 80s. And it still is open. I mean, the actual place where Atelier 17 was when Hayter died is still open, though it operates with a different name. And it has, again, one of Hayter's disciples, Hector Saunier, is sort of managing the studio, but it doesn't operate anymore as Atelier 17.
Interesting. Do you know, like, when he...
So that's a long story.
No, I appreciate it, though, because it's important to the context of all this, and to art history in general for people who haven't kind of heard this story, especially printmakers. Lisansky was one of the first people to leave Atelier 17 and then established the first printing program at a university at Iowa. And then from his student base, people would learn and study with him and then go off and start a new program. And so it was like, you know, this kind of pollination that all stemmed from Atelier 17 really coming here in that time. And so it was hugely impactful. And I think also that the historic time of when it all was happening was also impacted just by printing being what it was as like sort of a lesser status art form. Like, and it was more accessible. Like, could we talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, the New School was this really special place that I think helped to accelerate women's access to printmaking at Atelier 17. Not that it wasn't open to women when it was in Paris. Certainly, there were plenty of women who were there. But I think it could have been a little bit more difficult to approach it. And one of the artists who I talk about a lot in the book, Dorothy Daner, was in Europe with her husband, the sculptor David Smith. And he worked at the Atelier 17 when it was probably at 17 Rue Compagnie Première. But she felt she couldn't go because there were all these great artists who, you know, were there. But the fact of the matter was she and David both had the same level of training. So why was he more comfortable going there than she? But when Hayter moved the studio to America and opened at the New School, the New School was founded right after World War II, and it was founded by dissident academics who had been at Columbia, who felt that there needed to be a new model of higher education in the United States that wasn't so elitist, that would bring together faculty and students together on a collective kind of mission to change humanity, change the way that society worked. And so there wasn't this hierarchy of, you know, like teaching coming from the top down, that there was more collaboration between student and faculty and a flattening of this idea of learning. And so Hayter was part of the art faculty, which wasn't, you know, the New School had this huge university in exile for intellectuals who had been fired from their jobs from universities in Europe. So he wasn't technically part of this university in exile, but he was part of the larger idea of it. And so the art studios were meant to be open. You know, on paper, there wasn't supposed to be any prerequisite. You know, most of the New School classes were offered in the afternoons so that working men and women could come and take classes after their day jobs. Whether it was a lecture or, you know, an art workshop or something else. And they always aimed for the level to be very high. So it wasn't meant to be a sort of pastime. You know, you weren't coming to sort of be illuminated in some topic. You were there to do real thinking and research and all of that. So the New School was this really important accelerator for Italia 17. So Hayter, I think, did have some kind of portfolio review, but I mean, technically speaking, he wasn't supposed to be allowed to turn you away if you had no experience. So the level of people who came to the New School was very different. You had really trained and experienced artists like Reginald Marsh and Isabel Bishop come just for the novelty of learning how to make an engraving, because that was really what Hayter was so well known for by 1940. He was one of the only people who could teach you how to make an engraving. And then you had lots of younger people who were 18, 19, 20 years old who were coming based on references from people like Will Barnett and Harry Sternberg at the Art Students League and saying, you know, you should go and see what's happening at Atelier 17. So you have this varied level of students who are coming in to Atelier 17, but everybody is held to the same standard that you must kind of pick up the basics of making a print and then do something more with it. Something about the process of making a print was supposed to be generative for you, to generate more ideas, to take you in a new direction, to take printmaking as a field in a new direction. It wasn't a place to just sort of learn a rote skill and make editions. That was not what Atelier 17's mission was ever, but particularly becomes kind of encapsulated and clear when it comes to the New School. Hayter did quite a bit of writing also in his lifetime, but either the things that he wrote when he was in Paris have been lost because of the upheaval of having moved, or he just didn't write as much in the 30s. But really, like once he comes to New York, he starts writing and lecturing and produces two really important books, and that really does clarify what his position is about how the graphic arts should work within, creative fields.
You talked about at the time, like the preference for like Greenbergian theory. You know, Clement Greenberg was like sort of dividing art into fine art and then things that were made for mass appeal. So like the avant-garde and kitsch article that you mentioned. And I looked up to that and I thought about, that's been something that's plagued my career and probably lots of like graphic artists over time, that like there's still even today like this weird divide between art and craft, or fine art and commercial art, you know, as another terminology. Like, I don't know, it's hard to even know how to talk about it, because in a way it's all blending in such a way that you can't separate the two anymore.
Right. Well, they were in silos. I mean, you could have a print show, you could have a drawing show, you could have the painting show, the sculpture show, but there was no blurring of lines between them. And I have two anecdotes. One, you know, when Sue Fuller, who made these fantastic soft ground etching in the 40s, decided to make that leap to begin making what she called string compositions, where she was wrapping string on these open frames, and they had a rectangular format initially, and then she got commissions to make three-dimensional ones. Like at the McNay Art Museum in San Antonio, she made a huge three-dimensional circular one.
Oh, wow.
In any case, when she started making these rectangular ones, they were flat. She wanted them to be transparent and have them be visible from both sides. And she would get reviews when she'd show them at her gallery. People would call them decorative, almost like a screen, like a decorative screen, a Japanese screen that you would put as a room divider. And that wasn't their point, wasn't their purpose. Or when she entered them in museum exhibitions, she'd have to tell them, she'd have to check off a box and say, is this a painting or is this a sculpture? And people were very wary of this two-sided idea. So eventually she said, you know, whatever, I'm just going to put a colored piece of map board behind these and call them paintings, because I don't know what else to call them. And they did, you know, they did get into some shows, but it just shows you how difficult it was to navigate, like when you were doing something that wasn't quite the standard at the time. And I don't know what my second story was. I've lost my train of thought. But, you know, I think that that's indicative of what, you know, Hayter wanted. He wanted people to think in new and different ways and use their experience in prints to do, you know, this kind of more challenging work. But yeah, no, I totally agree today. It's so hard to define, like, what is a print? I do that with my students at Cooper Union when I teach a sort of survey of 20th century printmaking. We always think about it. And then at the end of the semester, I'll have them debate. I'll give them a couple of examples that I think are particularly tricky and have them debate. And it's interesting to hear what, you know, 18-year-olds have to say about, are we post-medium? Like, do we need to define these things as prints or not? Do we need to define them how they function? Like, I mean, they've got really interesting ways of thinking about printmaking and not a very restrictive way. I mean, they think of it more as just a means to get somewhere, which is cool.
Oh, it's so refreshing. Yeah. There was also in the book, you talked later about like the epic print and how, like, one way artists started trying to push the boundaries was by going bigger, which at the time was very technically difficult because paper didn't exist at the scale that people wanted it and materials were very expensive or unavailable. You know, it's mm-hmm. not like they had Home Depot and Lowe's everywhere. They could just go buy plywood endlessly. It was mm-hmm. much more difficult to find things, or you had to source them from, you know, building suppliers and things where, like, maybe, you know, large sheets of copper existed for roofing, but it's like it wasn't something that was available for artists. Like, so artists had to find all these workarounds to get their work done. But going big and right. adding color seemed like they had a lot of impact to broaden how print was received.
Right. I mean, the size thing is really an amazing thing to watch. And I've always wanted to do a project where sort of digital humanities project where I somehow scrape data from all these print annuals to see how the size expands from, you know, the 30s where everything's like 20 by 30 or smaller to, you know, charting it to the 50s where things really do get much bigger. And it was challenging. I mean, people talked about, like, you'd go to New York Central, this amazing, no longer existing art supply store. And, you know, they sold paper, and I think the biggest size was 30 by 40. So if you wanted anything bigger than that, you would have to seam it together, or you'd have to get creative. And somebody like Fred Becker, who is the artist I said went to University of Washington in St. Louis, he eventually, like, figured out that he could buy rolls of paper, but that it was some kind of industrial, I think it was bandaged, paper that was used for bandages. But he used it to make really large prints. So you had to think creatively. And I think it was also part of this, you know, the artists were trying to keep up with the size and the scale of paintings this time. And you just think about Jackson Pollock and, you know, all of the Apex artists, Robert Motherwell, they're all working on such a large scale that when you would just notice immediately this huge difference between going and seeing canvases and seeing a like dinky little print that was 10 by 15. So it was a way of sort of asserting the importance of what artists were doing in printmaking. You know, not that a small print didn't convey some of these ideas, but just putting it on a larger scale, I think, catches your attention, caught the attention of mid-century critics and potentially, you know, collectors, that these were important things to both buy and pay attention to. But they came with attendant problems, like how did you ship them and how did you frame them and all these things, which, as you say, today are so easy to figure out, but like back in the 50s, I think it was much harder. And the other problem, of course, is that most of the large things that were being done in the 50s were woodcuts because there just were not, the presses were just not built big enough. In, I don't know when the first large press was made, like whether it's Charles Brand or who's the guy in New Mexico, Tekash.
Yeah, Tekash. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I don't think that comes about until the '60s. So the press that they were using at Atelier 17 for their etchings and engravings was, I think, no bigger than like, I want to say 30 by 40. I think that number is in my book somewhere because they do have the old press somewhere. Somebody has it. But that was the limit. You couldn't do anything bigger than that unless you were working in a relief or as a screen printer.
It's like hard to imagine, you know?
Yeah, right?
Yeah, so many things about this topic all just blow my mind. Like the way that, you know, someone could open a print studio back then and have almost all of the relevant artists of the era, like, wander through the studios and do work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was curious, like, you know, Louise Bourgeois is, of course, like, a very known and revered artist. Like, she worked there, and Louise Nevelson also, and I've, you know, her work is in, like, every collection everywhere. Like, every museum you go into, they've got a Nevelson on the wall and a Bourgeois and or multiples, and I feel like after the initial work that artists were doing at the studio, like, many women went on to do feminist movements and starting art collectives and feminist collectives.
Right. And I think the point that I try to make later in the book is that everybody's reaction to the feminist art movement of the late 60s and 70s was different. You know, some artists really embraced it. Some were a little bit skittish about it. You know, Louise Bourgeois had a very sort of famous ambivalence about was she a feminist or not a feminist, even though many feminist artists and scholars embraced her as this model of sort of empowered female artist who, you know, spoke so much truth about her, her life and put that into the way that she made her art. You know, and so again, varied relationships with that. But I think one of the biggest things that I think is proto-feminist about Atelier 17 is that just women were all together. You know, they were practicing professional artists who shared the same communal work table together. And we don't know exactly what they said to one another, but just by being there and talking about, I'm going to put my work in this show, or I'm going to approach this gallery about having, putting my work in one of their group shows. You know, it just created this place of exchange and potentially, you know, as it escalated, like solidarity, community, you know, and some of the relationships that were founded at this communal table did go on to help start very important feminist connections later. Like, I don't think it's very well known that Miriam Shapiro, who was one of the founding artists of the feminist art movement, along with Judy Chicago, got her start in printmaking at the University of Iowa and then went to New York with her husband, worked briefly at Atelier 17 in New York. But some of the connections that she made both at Iowa and Atelier 17 come out later. Like, she and a Chicago-based artist named Ellen Lanyon and critic Lucy Lepard in the 70s founded an organization called the West East Fag, or WEB, which were these local feminist collectives where women artists would get together and talk about, you know, what were some of the challenges they were facing in getting their work shown. And so it was Lucy Lepard, Miriam Shapiro, Ellen Lanyon, and I think one more was involved. And so, like, that to me, what's so important about what Atelier 17 did is it just connected women. And even if they didn't go on to become self-professed feminists, they did have this feeling of solidarity among one another, and at differing levels. Certainly there were a lot of friendships that started both among men and women at the studio.
So I was thinking, if we were to do a Let's Get Technical segment.
Technical.
Ooh. I wanted to talk about Sue Fuller's use of fabric in Soft Ground.
Sure. So Sue Fuller, just to give listeners who may not be familiar with who she is, Sue Fuller was a Pittsburgh-based artist who got her initial undergrad work done at Carnegie Mellon. She graduated like at the height of the Depression. So she ended up at Teachers College at Columbia, and she worked with a printmaker at Teachers College named Arthur Young. And Arthur taught her a lot of the basics, but Sue was very, very just always wanting to know more. And she had Lumsden's Art of Etch, I think it's called The Art of Etching. And that was her Bible. And she really studied it very closely and would try to come up with all kinds of things that were trade secrets. She just sometimes couldn't figure out from what Lumsden was writing, what exactly, how was she supposed to put this all together? So it was through a lot of trial and error. And so she ends up at Atelier 17 because in addition to some of her other part-time gigs, she was doing the window displays at some of the New York department stores, and she was doing all kinds of other things. But she wanted to make jewelry, and she wanted to know how to engrave on jewelry. So she ends up at Atelier 17 because somebody said, oh, you should meet Hayter then. He knows how to do engraving. So anyway, she ends up there, and she finds immediately that this is going to be just a game changer for her. So she forgets about the jewelry. She learns engraving, and then she sees what Hayter is doing with soft ground etching. And she knew that soft ground etching existed as a process, but she just didn't quite have the ability to reverse engineer what the consistency of the soft ground should be. I think she'd added all kinds of different materials into her hard ground, and like nothing was really working. So she was very thankful for Hayter for like actually having the right material at the studio for her to use. But just then seeing the potential of soft ground was so much for her that it really consumed her for at least 5 years. And the way that Hayter advocated people use soft ground etching in their work was for shadow. You know, you would use material that was at the studio, like cheesecloth or tarlatan. And, you know, especially as the war was getting underway, there was a lot more sort of repurposing of textiles because you just didn't have access to new fabrics. It just, everything was being rationed. So in any case, if you look at Hayter's prints and many prints that come out of the studio, the soft ground is in the background. It's supportive of the linear composition. Mm-hmm. But Sue Fuller looked at this and said, you know, I see the potential for making a collage. And so her mother died in 1944. She inherited, as you said, she inherited all this lace from her mother, either things that she had made or things that had been passed down from generation to generation. And Sue decided that she was going to take it all apart, you know, and that's how this hen print became what it is today. Is she cut this lace collar basically in half and then folded it on top of itself. And she did this with many, many, many other pieces of lace that that she had inherited from her mother. And so then it becomes a primary element in her prints. It's no longer supportive of a linear composition. It is, you know, what she's doing. You know, it all becomes about the textiles and the fabrics. So yeah, she was really amazing. And then this influences other artists because she's a studio monitor, because of her experience. You know, she knew how to do so much that she's there and she's helping people like Anne Ryan figure out how to make her prints initially. And then Anne Ryan goes on in the late 40s to begin making these beautiful collages. And a lot of people have written that, oh, you know, she saw a show of Kurt Schwitter's collages at one of the galleries in New York, and this is the moment that really spurred her towards making her collages. And I think it all had a foundation in what she was doing in soft ground etching with Sue Fuller and Stanley Hayter at Atelier 17. I think that was really the origin of Anne Ryan's collage work. Maybe seeing Kurt Schwitter's was like the moment that snapped and she's like, okay, well, I'm going to go and make these collages. But certainly, you know, she was practicing collage on her plates, on her Atelier 17 etchings as early as 1944 and 45. So I don't know.
That's generally it.
That's my technical thing. I mean, if you want to also, we could go back to this idea that we talked about yesterday with Sue Fuller. I mean, she's really, I think, I love her. I think she's such a underappreciated artist. She just is one of these people who talked and wrote and was so intelligent and really underappreciated. But we talked yesterday about one of the other innovations that she kind of reverse engineered, because you know, again, people knew how to do sugar lift. They knew how to do sugar lift etching. It was a trade secret. She had seen, I mean, Sue went to all of the print collections in the city. She went to the New York Public Library. She went to the Metropolitan Museum because she wanted to see other historic examples of people's prints. I mean, she looked at Katie Kollwitz's prints. She looked at George Ruault's prints. And she wanted to get that, like, that line, that aquatinted line that was very brushstrokey that you see in a lot of Ruault's prints. And then she's like, I don't know how to do that. So she goes back to her Lumsden book, and she's reading and reading, and she sees mention of, I've forgotten who the artist is, who was using something that Lumsden called direct black aquatint. And then she sits in her kitchen, and she starts to experiment with different materials in her kitchen, including Carol corn syrup. And then she figures out that she can use Carol corn syrup to do, you know, sort of like sugar lift aquatint. And boom, then she's able to draw she's able to draw on her plates, which was, you know, something that people at Atelier 17 weren't really doing. And this was really hugely influential, because then she goes back and teaches it to a bunch of other people. And then it becomes, you know, like Carol corn syrup is just constantly on the shelves at Atelier 17. And then it becomes on the shelves of everybody's studios, you know, and it's because Sue figured out that that was a really convenient and easy way to work. But nobody really knows that.
Oh, it's a great example of innovation that was lost to history. And like I said yesterday, it's like we all do these things that are rather established practices, but someone at some point like innovated and came up with what these things are.
Well, I don't think that there was anybody really like leading the way there. I think that was part of what Atelier 17 was all about, that mm-hmm. if you wanted to know, you had to do it. But Sue seemed to be a particularly just engaged artist in the sense that if there was something that she wanted to know, she was going to figure it out. And if that meant a lot of trial and error, she was going to do it. And so she did.
Yeah, I really enjoyed learning more about her. There was also this wonderful comparison of going back to that rooster piece, how she combined these feminine artifacts of like the lace with what at the time was a very masculine medium of engraving. And I'd never really mm-hmm. thought about it, but all the way people talk about like when you attack a plate and you engrave it, you know, it's that was all language developed by men to try to masculinize their medium to find more acceptance in the art world, which like was just really interesting perspective to learn about.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's what really took so much time to put together. Is I would read one statement about engraving or one statement about the use of lace and texture. And I would say, you know, that's interesting. And I would mark it down and I'd like go and I'd find something else a couple months later that talked about engraving as this masculine art, and then I would like again put it into my research notes, and I'd be like, okay, well now I'm starting to see a more consistent way that people are talking about engraving as this masculine craft, because printmaking really did have to dig its way out from being a craft into mm-hmm. being something that could be respected as a fine art and something worthy of producing. You know, expressing the angst and the anxiety that people were feeling during and after World War II. But yeah, like as I started to piece this all together, I was like, I'm not making this up. You know, like people are literally talking about engraving as this like way of you know, like reinvigorating printmaking in a masculine way. So
interesting too, as I think about it, like when I took intaglio at Iowa, like my first, I think my print one class, or maybe it was print two, like in a second level undergrad, like they taught engraving to everybody. Like we all had to learn engraving.
Oh, they did.
Oh yeah. And it's something I forget that I learned, and it was such a normal thing. Like everybody did it. We all had a bunch of tools and learned how to sharpen them. I would spend hours just like honing just the edges of my burins and stuff, and then engraving stuff. And then it turns out it was truly like this thing that disseminated from the Atelier 17 through Lisansky, through the people he taught, like Virginia Myers. And then I study with Virginia Myers, and I learned tons of engraving technique from her. And it all stems from all those people working together and learning.
Well, I've taken, as I said to you yesterday, I've taken a few printmaking classes. So, you know, at this point, I know pretty well. I need a little bit of assistance. I like don't have all the materials here at home, but yeah, if I go into a shop, I can definitely scratch out an etching or something. But the most fantastic experience was getting to make an engraving with an artist who's based here in New York named David Bartol. And there just aren't that many people who teach it, so I'm really pleased to hear that it continues at Iowa. Because besides David, I know, you know, there's Andrew Raftery who's at RISD, but I don't know many other people who are actively, you know, forming disciples of engraving, but I found it to be just this most amazing experience. Like I loved it. And, I just wish I had more time and, ideas to put down into a copper plate, but I do have my little sample I made with David. It's like a little leaf, but it was so much fun. I really, really enjoyed it. So,
oh, it's a great technique. Like I'm so happy I have background with it. And yeah, the artists I can think of that I know of that do it actively are like, James Ehlers is one who teaches at Emporia State, in Kansas, I believe. And, one of his students, Ashton Ludden, not sure where she is now, but she actually came through a studio I used to work at in Kansas City, and she was like a very active engraver and just was very proud and pushing it and doing it and, you know, making really great, really detailed, beautiful work with it too. So it's still alive, but it is still a very niche thing, you know, like mezzotint, like there are people who do it somewhere, but it's not nearly the most common thing.
Yeah, I think at one point Andrew Raftery told me that one place that engraving is flourishing is it goes back to its roots in to the creation of decorative armor. But there are apparently a lot of schools and programs that teach engraving for kind of like decorative guns. You know, like the if you think of an old rifle or something, there's some amount of engraving that's happening on those like collector's items.
There's actually, yeah, now that I'm thinking about it, there's I found a woman I feel like last year who's like a video content creator. She makes her living doing all kinds of custom engraving, but she'll engrave like things that people send her. So she's done, you know, all kinds of objects and things in the style of how guns maybe were done, but I'm thinking she does like padlocks, like she'll engrave padlocks with like really intricate patterning, and like they're just like gorgeous, like so beautiful, and she's like putting out videos and making a huge following, like doing of all things engraving in the world today. Yeah, so there's an angle, if you know, if people dive into it, it's like you can make it a very popular thing through the work that you do with it if you do it right today. So it's interesting.
Well, that just reminds me about something that's so cool about Atelier 17 is that often the artists would keep their plates and they would exhibit the copper plates alongside their prints as sort of an object in and of itself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I know that that's maybe more common today. It's a didactic thing. You know, we sort of look at it and we can learn from what we see on the plate and how it comes out marking on the paper. But I think that was something that Hayter really championed, you know, thinking about it, the plate as an object And he would cancel his plates by basically signing them the right way on the plate. So like you could exhibit them and you would see it was by Hayter, but of course if you ever went to print it, his signature would be backwards. It's very clever.
Oh wow. That's super clever. Yeah. Like I don't know. I never had a reason to truly cancel a plate, but I see, you know, some people like scar them or literally destroy them.
It's a really clever idea to put your signature in the corner and then, you know, you can keep the plate indefinitely. It's beautiful. You haven't marred it. You haven't put a slash mark through it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now today, you know, I'm sure you go to all the fairs and things like that, but Dolan Maxwell, a gallery that's based in Philadelphia, has a strong relationship with Hayter's estate. And so every once in a while, you'll get to see one of his plates that they kind of resurrected from the archive. And they'll sell those knowing that, you know, they can't be ever reeditioned.
Wow. That's a great kind of endpoint. So we were kind of hitting time, but I wanted to thank you for coming on to the show. And I appreciate you sharing and just doing all this work because I think it's important to amend history in the ways that this book does. And I appreciate it being like print focused, which is kind of, you know, rare in the art history world. Like there's not a ton of scholarship in printmaking. So thank you for doing all the hard work and spending all that time putting this book together. It's been a really interesting read and I've learned a lot just digging into it.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
So yeah, my guest today is Christina Weil. Her book is titled The Women of Atelier 17, Modernist Printmaking in Mid-Century New York. And I believe I found mine on Amazon, but is there anywhere you would recommend people look into getting a copy of this?
I think, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore, doesn't make me a ton of money. So please support your local bookstores if you can.
I appreciate your time.
Thanks.
Thanks for tuning into the Printcast. Also, thank you to my guest, Christina Weil, for coming on the podcast to share about her book, The Women of Atelier 17. Like she said, it's available online, but please support your local booksellers because we need local businesses, frankly, to survive 2020, and anything can help, especially if you're not choosing Amazon once in a while. So, also, like I mentioned before, you can help the Printcast by supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/theprintcast for as little as $3 a month. Thanks for listening to the Printcast, everybody. I'll see you all next time.
You've been listening to the Printcast, a podcast about print shops, the artist, the process, and all the things we make. If you like what you were listening to, help us get the word out by subscribing and leaving a 5-star review and sharing with your friends on social media. You can find the Printcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, as well as on the website printcast.com. Music for the show is by Jazar. Voiceover provided by Jim Birdsall and Rhiannon Birdsall. Take care of yourselves and each other, and we'll see you again on another episode of the Printcast. Bye for now.